Service.
It's the Burning the Ivory Towers edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, Insight's Supreme Win, Science on Trial, and Crossing the Divide Between Scientists and the Public. Let's begin episode 135.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross sword, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of star stuff. We are aware of the cosmos and know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others. We have traveled this way before. And there is much to be learned.
Hello, and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your freethinking historian.
And I'm Don, your political science philosopher.
Jenna, your biochemist.
You know, so we had an interesting thing this week,
What's
if
that?
I remember correctly. I always get my dates confused. But weren't we supposed to go around saying the Pope is a poophead and Jesus was gay and all sorts of things that are like, you know, what's that B word that they keep throwing around?
Blasphemous.
Blasphemous. Wasn't there like sort of a day for that?
Yes, there was a day.
Is this sort of like Walk Like a T-Rex Day? Because that's one of my favorites.
I haven't heard of that one.
No, that's a new one. When is that day?
I don't remember, but it's sort of akin to Walk Like a, Talk Like a Pirate Day or Ninja Stealth Day.
Interesting.
Oh.
Well, Talk Like a Pirate Day wasn't bad. But Blasphemy Day, that's right, it happened last week. And it was lots of fun. I went to the booth that was set up by the UBC Freethinkers where we blasphemed. And it was great. And people came out and we had a little option where you could sell your soul for a cookie.
Ooh.
And so people were selling their souls. And some guy, we asked one guy if he wanted to sell his soul. And he was like, no, I sold it to rock and roll. So it was like, well, that's a good cause too.
You know, did you have anyone go by and sell their soul twice? Because, I mean, if you're going to deal in non-existent things, you can have a six-pack of souls, I guess.
That brought up some good discussion points because we were sort of debating, like, what happens if you've already sold your soul? And I was saying that, well, I think it grows back. So
spontaneous generation. You know, there's one of the things, and I don't think this happened in ours, right? I mean, in the past, and I've kind of harped on this about how Blasphemy Day can become sort of a anti-racist or a pro-racist sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
None of that occurred this year.
Not that I know of. We were pretty, I think the club did a very good job of making it clear that this was about criticizing ideas and not people. And I think most folks get that. It's still very...
The Pope's a person.
Yeah, sure. Some people, you know, still don't understand Blasphemy Day. I had a few discussions with some people, both on sort of the secular side and on the non-secular side, about Blasphemy Day. And, you know, people kind of shy away from it because they don't want to offend people. But, you know, no one has the right to go through life unoffended. And if someone is offended by our mere existence, that's kind of a rough spot to get around.
You know, it's funny, too, that, you know, that some people will raise issues about this, invalid issues. But, I mean, I know in the States just recently they had a big kerfuffle about anti-government type people selling cookies. And they were racially based cookies, as in if you were a white person, they charge you $2. If you were Hispanic, they charge you $1.50. If you're black, they charge you $1. All with the intent to show you how tough it is for the white man in the United States. And they've been doing this for years. But last time they did it, which was about 2 months ago or a month ago, it became big news story about, oh, look at all this racism and all that. And it's just any protest can easily be taken the wrong way. I mean, I don't agree with this one particular protest with the cookies. But I mean, you know, you can always pick on anything.
Yeah, well, there's always the chance something is going to go wrong. I think this time I didn't see anything go terribly wrong. It really just comes down to, you know, have good planning. And if something does start to go wrong, have a plan to solve the problem. And I think in this case, they were able to do that.
Well, I knew some kindergarten teachers that were just up in arms about this day because it went against one of their central tenets. If you don't have anything nice to say, don't say anything at all.
That wasn't very nice of you. You shouldn't have said that.
But well, the problem with that, though, is people always assume that blasphemy is direct criticism of religion, i.e. saying, you know, if you're Catholic, you're wrong. But simply saying something like evolution is true is also blasphemy. And
of course, Bible is not the unerring word of God.
Yeah.
Well, these kindergarten teachers, they weren't very enlightened.
Well, most kindergarten teachers aren't, so.
Speaking of not being enlightened. Now, that sounds a
little... That's right, I said it.
I went right over your segue.
It's okay.
Sorry, kindergarten teachers. We think you're important. Thank you for teaching us to share.
So tell us, Ethan, about something that was enlightening.
Well, so as a lot of our listeners know, there was a big ruling today, or last Friday. The Supreme Court of Canada has ruled that InSight, Vancouver's safe injection clinic, where drug users can receive free needles and a safe place to do drugs under medical supervision, has been, upheld. That InSight cannot be closed by the current federal government. So this trial was the final stage of an 8-year struggle to get Canada's only safe injection site legally protected from ideological shutdown. So a bit of background. InSight was created in 2003 under a special exemption from Canada's drug trafficking and possession laws under Section 56 of the Controlled Drugs and Substance Act, the CDSA. This exemption by the Liberal government of Canada allowed the Vancouver Coastal Health Authority and the Portland Hotels Society to establish InSight. They had a 3-year exemption from the laws, and in 2006, the federal health minister of the new Conservative government extended this extension by 15 months. Fearing that InSight would be closed after that, the Portland Hotel Society and two InSight users filed a claim with the BC Supreme Court, urging them to declare that InSight was the jurisdiction of the province and not the federal government. And they had another legal battle over this in the BC courts. And InSight was allowed to continue on the basis that Canada's drug trafficking laws violated Section 7 of the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. However, InSight was not ruled to be the specific domain of British Columbia. So both sides appealed this decision. The Conservative government appealed the ruling that the drug laws violated the Charter. And PHS appealed the ruling that InSight was not the domain of the province. So this led to our current legal battle in the courts today. And like I said, last Friday, the ruling came down that InSight is allowed to stay open. But there's a bit of detail on all this. Before we get to the sort of nitty-gritty, I want to kind of go over why we as skeptics actually should be concerned about this. And I wrote a blog post about this for Skeptic North a while back, but the short version is that InSight is relying on science-based medicine as a way of curbing drug use. Now, the idea here is that InSight is using harm reduction drug policy, and as opposed to, say, the war on drug policy. Now, as InSight has been open for a while now, it's accumulated a lot of scientific peer-reviewed research. It indicates that, it turns out, harm reduction is actually working, and it's working better than the war on drugs.
So does this put the Conservative government in a position of having a war on harm reduction?
Well, you could say that it's put the Conservative government in a position where if you want to support ideologically based drug policy, which is essentially what the war on drugs is, then you're now in opposition to science.
And so just to clarify, when you say that it is working, by what metrics are we using to determine that?
Well, one metric I know I heard just the other day was there's been at least 72 lives that were saved by people who OD'd, but they OD'd in the safe environment and they were saved, essentially.
Right.
So that is one of the metrics they are using.
Well, in addition, InSight sort of has a number of key objectives. One is obviously to reduce overdose death. One is to encourage treatment. Things like cutting down on the transmission of HIV.
Mm-hmm.
All these various different health factors. And what has become clear is that InSight is succeeding in all of these areas quite well, actually. And the success rate has gotten a lot of, addiction specialists basically quite eager to see InSight replicated in other cities. So a lot of people want to see an InSight in Ottawa and Montreal and such and such. So that's kind of where the science is on InSight. And when the trial was happening, this is what was presented to the judge. And so the Supreme Court gave its ruling, and what they've come up with is that InSight is not the exclusive domain of the province of British Columbia, and that the Controlled Drugs and Substance Act does apply to healthcare.
Can I read the two? There's two quotes from the actual the actual ruling that I liked, I thought kind of puts it into context, maybe.
Sure.
Based on the information available to the minister, this limit is not in accordance with the principle of fundamental justice. It is arbitrary regardless of which test of arbitrariness is used, because it undermines the very purpose of the CDSA, the protection of health and public safety. Later on, it states, it is also grossly disproportionate. During its 8 years of operation, Insight has been proven to save lives with no discernible negative impacts on public safety and the health objectives of Canada. The effect of denying the service of Insight to the population it serves and its the correlative increase in the risk of disease and death.
Right. So what Don just alluded to there is that despite the fact that the courts have ruled that Insight has to abide by the law, and it can't be administered by the province. It has ruled that closing Insight at this point is, as Don said, arbitrary. Because of the proven benefits, closing Insight infringes on the charter rights of the people who must have a right to medical treatment. So this ruling is pretty important in a lot of different ways, and I mean, we can discuss, I think, at length the effects this is going to have on harm reduction drug policy, but that's kind of going a bit beyond this main segment here. The important thing is that science has upheld in the courts and was not trumped by ideology, which I think is a really important step, especially when we consider that we have a conservative majority government, and if they had the precedence to overturn science here, they could overturn it in other places. And this does open the door for more insights. I don't know if they'll keep calling them insights. I don't know what they're going to call them. But, of course, it will have to still go through the conservative government. So chances are it's not going to happen. But maybe in 4 or 5 years, when we have a new government that's a bit more open to science, we will see more harm reduction drug policy in the future.
And to go on with what Ethan was saying earlier, I mean, why is this important to skeptics? Well, we've done a number of segments on our show where politics is not being rationally determined, but being driven by ideological concerns of one form or another. And that what we do need to do is we need to make the concept of rationality, science, logical thinking more an important part of politics. We tend to see politics as something that is sort of social and organic, and you've got to feel it. It's a motive. And maybe that works for the way you want to vote. I don't think so. But when it comes to how the country runs, how things are actually done, the only real effective way to determine what at least are the possibilities is to use a reasonable, rational, scientific sort of approach. It doesn't mean you have to pick any one particular answer, but the answers that you have in front of you are ones that will accomplish the goal you're supposedly wanting to accomplish.
That's a good point, right? I mean, we're talking about here science and medicine, but this intersects with law, which intersects with politics. So when we're electing our politicians, we want them to be aware of how the laws that they pass are going to impact science and what the science and the medical opinion says about how effective those laws will be. I mean, I'm sure that most of us don't want to see, no laws about drug trafficking and killing people for drugs. I'm sure that in some cases those laws are pretty good. But, you know, if the science is saying that this drug, this legal policy of dealing with drugs is not working at all, surely we have to come to some kind of new rational interpretation of how to apply these laws.
I'd just like to sort of interject one extra idea into this discussion. We've sort of been talking about almost a dichotomy between a ideological point of view and one of hard science. And I think that a lot of the time, to touch on something you talked about, Don, as far as what the politicians are appealing to, it's not only the ideologies of the public that's voting for them, but also their ideas that might not actually be ideological based necessarily, especially in a case like this, but maybe just ill-informed. Mm-hmm. So for a lot of people looking to improve the drug situation, because I think everybody's looking to improve the drug situation, there are the people that are going to say, from an ideological point of view, like, this is wrong, therefore we can't use it as part of the solution. There are people that are going to say, the science says that it works, so we should use it as part of the solution. And then there's probably part of the population we haven't really been talking about that says, you know, this is counterintuitive that this would work. Like, I don't think that this would work, but don't have the actual information to back that up. Excuse me. And so I think part of the problem, again, is making sure that both the policymakers as well as their constituents have the information from that science-based research that's going to help them to make the rational decisions that they might be trying to make but not have the right tools.
Right. And that's basically the theme of today's episode. We're discussing science when it comes into contact with both, I guess, law, but also how we communicate that science to our politicians and our lawmakers.
And the whole idea of, I mean, common sense. I mean, it's a term we throw around quite a lot. But as Jenna was alluding there, that sometimes what is sensible is counterintuitive. I mean, you think, well, if we want to get rid of drugs in our society, we should just outlaw them. I mean, it worked for alcohol. Why shouldn't it work for cocaine and all that?
And sometimes there's no way to know without the hard data. Like, no matter, it's the whole thing of scientific research, you know, going through hypothesis and then hypothesis testing. You can't know what's logical without having the data. And so if people don't have the appropriate information, no one is able to make rational choices.
Yeah, that was the great thing that I found out when I was researching Insight the first time, is how much peer-reviewed science they've collected over these years. And they've done a great job of presenting that. And, you know, I think that as skeptics, we should really sort of promote this, because we don't often talk about this sort of thing in the skeptical movement. And it's really quite interesting when you break it into the science. Let's go to a commercial break here on Radio Freethinker, and we'll be back with more after this.
This is Phil Plait of BadAstronomy.com, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM for UBC in Vancouver, British Columbia.
Science is the best tool ever devised for understanding the world.
To subscribe to the Radio Freethinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes, subscribe via iTunes or at RadioFreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker.
Ethan.
Yes.
Guess what?
What?
Science is on trial yet again. But it's not the Christians this time.
No witch hunts?
No. Well, actually, it is kind of a witch hunt, actually. In the place that maybe invented witch hunts. I'm not quite sure on the origins of the whole witch story. We mentioned on earlier episodes about a group of six Italians who were charged with manslaughter of 309 people for failing to predict an earthquake that hit the town of L'Aquila in 2009. Well, the trial began last week. The scientists were on a committee that was tasked with assessing the risks of recent seismic activity in the area. At a press conference, the group assured the public that there was no danger. After the quake, many of the victims' relatives said that because of these reassurances, they didn't take quote-unquote precautionary measures, such as leaving their homes. Now, at first glance, we might say that charges are ridiculous. Most of us on this show...
Whoa, wait. Sorry, I have to interrupt you. They didn't take precautions like leaving their homes when they started shaking?
No, they would have slept outside. See, once it starts to shake, it can be too late to leave your
okay.
home.
See,
so
I
the
was...
idea would have been people to have gone to relatives or to gone to the park or something.
Like,
and
wow,
slept
these people
there.
Have some real faith in those scientists. Like, the house is coming down, but I'm sure it's not an earthquake. Sorry, continue.
No, that would be that's funny. I'm glad you can take humor out of all of this.
you know nice. Me, morbid to the end.
So at first glance, like I say, most of us who know a little bit about science knows that, you know, we can't actually reliably predict earthquakes. Actually, can't really predict them at all. But strictly speaking, that is not what they are being charged with. The L'Aquila public prosecutor is arguing that although the committee members could not have predicted the earthquake, they should have translated their scientific uncertainty better and not in a quote-unquote overly optimistic message that they did deliver. This translates quite well, actually, into the series of segments that we've done about the challenges that scientists have when trying to communicate specialized information to a non-specialized masses. One line in particular of the report that the committee gave, or actually at the meeting that they gave, which was actually stated by a government official on the committee, who is also charged along with the scientist, stated, and I quote, "The scientific community tells me there is no danger because there is an ongoing discharge of energy. The situation looks favorable."
This is the overly optimistic tone that they're being
talking about.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, like I say, if you listen to it, it sounds like, oh, well, don't worry about it. You know, if it's going to happen, it won't be big and that sort of thing.
So overly optimistic, you know, you get charged.
Well, one of the lines in here that was actually picked out is the word no danger. When that's sort of where all this hinges.
There's never no danger of anything.
We'll get there.
No danger of unicorn attacks.
Well, there is.
Not true.
There is more to
this. We just
don't
have the data to support it.
Continue, Don.
There is more to this. On the prosecutor side, there are a number of scientific experts who are pointing out that the discharge of energy doesn't make quakes any less likely. It's not an accepted position in the scientific community. In fact, in my research, statistics point that it's actually the opposite. About 50% of all earthquakes are preceded by what they call a forequake, as opposed to
before.
Yeah. That can happen a day or 2 days before the primary quake. However, when you say, they could have predicted it. But of the earthquakes that happen, only about 5 or 10% of them fall into this sort of forequake category. So again, you get a lot of false alarms and no real real prediction ability. It also emerged that the committee was not actually unanimous in its belief that earthquakes were unlikely. One member, Enzo Busucci, the then president of Italy's National Institute of Geophysics and Volcanology, I thought Vulcans were fake. said at a town meeting, it is unlikely that an earthquake like the one in 1703 could occur in the short term, but the possibility cannot be totally ruled out.
So right after saying that, he was kicked in the shins for being alarmist.
Yes. I wonder how many people remember the 1703 quake. I mean, many people in the... Anyhow, I'm doing what you're doing. On the other hand, one of the accused stated, if we were to alert the population every time something like this happened, we would probably have been indicted for unjustifiable alarm.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, one of the factors that led to the way the government official phrased the favorable announcement is several weeks earlier, another controversial Italian researcher, Galampo Gelini, claimed that based on radon readings, that an earthquake was imminent, to the point where a group traveled throughout the city telling everyone via megaphone to evacuate immediately. Now, he made this prediction on March 29th, or that's the date he said that it would probably happen, which was over a week early. Because of the numerous tremors, there was a sort of a growing sense of panic in the region. You had sort of the quacks that we often talk about saying, oh, the end is near, which they always say. So there was a strong desire on the part of the government to try and reduce this tension, this sort of sense of panic in the community, and allow cooler heads to prevail. Now, of course, some have argued that actually this whole trial thing is actually a misdirect and that the real culprit here was poor building standards that led to the collapses and subsequent deaths in themselves. This may or may not be true, but it's not what we're going to be talking about here today. Now, these are the facts in the case. However, there are two camps that are emerging out of this, out of this thing. One is sort of on the side of the scientific community that stands sort of with bated breath to know whether or not the next utterance that they make will find them in court, explaining why they did not predict the unpredictable. That the response from science is going to be complete silence. They just don't want to risk saying something that they're going to be thrown in court.
No. Then they're going to be charged with withholding information.
So, and that's sort of one of the camps, right? Of course, people of those views, you know, lament the absence of understanding that science is not an exact science. That much of what is presented as scientific conclusions are actually probabilistic. One analogy I heard that was going around was if a meteorologist said that the odds of rain today were 60%, would you assume if it rained? Would you assume if it didn't? I mean, it's a probabilistic thing. There is no real absolutes, especially in something like earthquake predictions, which is innately unpredictable.
Well, there's that movie, The Weatherman, where people chuck fast food at the main character when it rains. So maybe you do sue the weatherman.
So like I say, that's sort of the one camp, right, which is what you're hearing most about here, because again, the scientific community is worried about the repercussions on this. The other camp essentially accepts that science is not always certain, but that the communication was not by a scientist, but a government official who may have allowed political considerations to color the manner with which he communicated that uncertainty. Second, that given the uncertainty and the role that they shouldn't have said that there was no danger, that they should have actually said something more like, an earthquake is possible, but unlikely. However, simple precautions should still be taken, like sleeping outdoors. Mm-hmm. Sort of that, you know, if you're going to err on the side of public safety, even though that in itself, as you mentioned, may get them into some hot water. And they are. They're worried that if they yell wolf too much, they're going to become ineffective. But I'm not sure if that really quite holds, because even if it becomes ineffective, we've already said that they can't predict it. So even if people sort of ignore their advice, those who will listen to it, again, will be on the side of good, because their advice kind of was meaningless in this case as it was. One thing I thought was interesting was one of the quotes of the prosecutor. He said, and I quote, "Nobody here wants to put science in the docket. All we want was clear information on risks in order to make our choices." End quote. Sadly, many things in science do not allow for a clear answer.
True that.
No, and again, this is where we have this sort of divide, this gap between scientific information and what people want, what people need to hear. I mean, I can empathize with the people in this village who lost relatives and all that, right? Because they trusted the scientific community to tell them I just want to have a certain answer. What should I do? I can't live my life probabilistically. I can't have 60% of me living outside the house and 40% in the house. They need that certainty in order to live, but science can't always deliver that.
Well, it's almost sort of on the same vein as, you know, like, if you are in the middle of a new disease outbreak or that kind of thing, and you need a treatment or you need a vaccine to survive, but it just can't happen fast enough. You know, this is not the fault of the people working on it. This is just fact.
Well, I mean, the problem with this is that a statement was issued that there was no danger, which is different from saying that there might be a danger. They specifically said, don't panic, it's okay, you're going to be fine. And then they weren't fine, which is justifiably, you know, not proper. So, I mean, you can make the case that, okay, the scientists told the government official something and the government official kind of went, huh?
Spun it.
And, you know, said, oh, everything's going to be okay. Or you can make the case that, you know, the scientists just screwed up. I don't know.
I would like to hear the response from the crowd listening when they say, well, there might not be any danger. We don't really think there is, but...
No, and actually, again, you know, that brings up this important issue that, you know, how do you translate uncertainty to people who are looking for certainty? Again, the scientists are not on trial because they could not predict the earthquake. They said, yes, you can't do it. We know that. But the information that was provided was misleading. And again, it's such a, no danger does say something specific.
Well, we've talked about it.
And something that honestly, because they can't predict earthquakes, they should not have said.
It's true.
Right?
So I think that, I mean, the crux of it comes down to something we've talked about before and something we're going to discuss more today, which is just increasing the level of comfort and literacy that the public has with scientific methods, scientific language, and science in general to be able to make these communications effective and easier. So let's go to a commercial break and we'll talk more about it when we come back.
In the sky, standing on a planet. Really, I'm just a speck compared with a star.
Radio Free Thinker is broadcast Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also hear us Mondays at 8 a.m. on UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Free Thinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Free Thinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
The state of hip hop right now, man, as far as the way I see it, I think right now hip hop is advancing as far as skills. You got brothers, you know what I'm saying, getting like more witty.
There ain't nobody to be pretty for. Let it rattle, let the clatter kill him, let the cataclysm wash. Who really listens? Precision with a verse draws a crowd. I draw a line between an easy melody and peace of mind.
Uh-huh. You got DJs doing all kind of crazy shit on the turntables. I like where it's going, and I like, you know what I'm saying, the creative process that brothers is trying to take it to right now.
Rally Rails and Brendan Butter in the place to be. Crimes and Treasons Radio, 101.9 FM, Vancouver, CITR.ca, every Tuesday, 9 till 11.
Dynamite!
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. So, Jenna.
Yep.
Tell us about this divide between science and communicating science.
Well, as we were talking about in our last segment, I mean, I think that there are some major issues that can arise in society and that have practical consequences, like people being put on trial for manslaughter. When there's an issue communicating science from where it's generated in, you know, the realm of scientists, to people that don't live in that world every day and, you know, the general public. So I really want to just reiterate how important effective public communication of the sciences is. And I think that our last story really demonstrated that fairly well. So throughout history, ruling bodies have known that knowledge gives people in a populace power. So ruling classes or oppressive groups have always tried to restrict independent access to information through discouraging or forbidding literacy or outlawing certain forms of publications or writing or outlawing public forums or discussion of certain topics. So in short, the political power has time and time again been protected through this type of censorship, which really shows the understanding of how powerful information can be in a society. So as many people I'm sure would agree, this goes on today. This is a really important issue, not just in places we consider to have oppressive governments, but also here, and apparently in Italy, in our political moderate democracy as well. So in fact, the fact that our votes determine who gets into office puts an enormous emphasis on our individual understanding of the issues and our abilities to make decisions based on them. We want an educated public to make educated decisions like we were talking about earlier in order for the policies to be based on science and rationality as opposed to either arbitrary or ideological basis. So if we don't have this understanding, the alternative is basically being fed slanted information and making potentially bad political and social decisions with all the consequences that come along with that.
Current government.
Yes. So in my mind, you know, fostering public scientific understanding and forthright and effective scientific communication strategies should really be a topmost goal for several professions, including scientists and journalists and everyone that's involved in that, you know, communication process from the source. So we've had a lot of discussions about scientific communication lately, and there's been somewhat of a focus on the media's responsibilities vis-a-vis accurate reporting of science and some of the motivations inherent for, you know, for-profit media models that might oppose what many scientists would consider proper reporting of science. So, you know, we've sort of demonized, or I have occasionally demonized, the popular media in their communication strategies when it comes to science. So, of course, there is another major partner in the creation of scientific communications, and this is, of course, the scientists. And at the outset of this discussion, I would just like to say again that the partnership between media and scientists is paramount, and that the problems that we see with science reporting in the media can't really be laid at the feet of one group or the other, and it's truly a failing of both. And we really need to work from both sides on this to improve, and neither one can be exonerated when we talk about ineffective science communication. So I should also say that lots of the topics I'll touch on came from an article in Nature Chemistry recently by Matthew Hardings and Declan Fay called Communicating Chemistry for Public Engagement. So obviously this article is specifically in relation to chemistry, but a lot of the general discussion points and ideas are applicable to the sciences in general. So according to these authors, one of the major problems that scientists face in communicating chemistry to the public and science in general is what they call chemophobia. So we could call it scienceophobia? Science phobia?
Yeah, we'll work on that one.
Yeah, okay. You get on that one. And this is pretty much exactly what it sounds like. People not wanting to talk...
Factophobia.
There actually is...
Triviophobia sounds more like factophobia.
A scientist coined a term, I believe it was called logophobia, which is fear of critical thinking. And I read that in a Skeptical Inquirer article a few months back.
So I feel this is something slightly different than that. So we're just going to call it fear
Fine.
Of science right now for
Whatever,
the purpose
Jenna,
of the discussion.
These are new words. They scare me.
Well, here we go. We'll figure out what we're talking about here. So people basically don't want to talk or hear about science and sort of avoid it in the media because they're afraid of it. So this obviously isn't on an enormously conscious level, but the idea is that often when people hear about scientific topics in the media, it is in the context of something very serious and dangerous. So we hear about radiation in the event of malfunctions or bombs, but not the fact that the sun is doing it all day long or that we need, you know, certain radiation treatments to help with cancer
well,
and that
no,
kind
even,
of thing.
Even with even the idea of radiation treatment, I think that goes in the negative because, I mean, radiation is killing cells.
Yeah.
You know, okay, they're bad cells, but they're still murdering my cells. And that's a negative context, even if it is for good.
Definitely. And when we talk about radiation treatment and stuff, we're not often talking about the positive outcomes, but, you know, the hair loss and other things that can happen from that.
Well, even with your one example, sorry, just to beat this horse completely, is you are mentioning that radiation often is brought up in the media as a rare exception, whereas the sun is an everyday. I mean, these
yeah,
things are around you
for
every
sure.
day, and every day they don't do anything horrible or bad, and we don't think of that because it's all we get to communicate it is the blips on the road.
Yeah, the really serious negative consequences of certain things that, yeah, are everyday science concepts. Things like we hear about BPA and the dangers of that in our water bottles, but not necessarily how, you know, plastics in general and that type of technology has enabled all kinds of things that you can't do with any other material in industry and in medicine and really making our lives what they are. So the bottom line that we hear most of the time when we're hearing specifically, explicitly about a scientific topic, it's in the context of something negative or scary. So this, you know, we pay attention to pollutants and drugs and chemical warfare and other scary, scary things. But the problem is that without a firm intellectual grasp, like you were saying, on the actual scientific principle and how common these things are, then the mind connects these scary connotations with any science in that field. So they lump them all together under the banner of, you know, I don't fully understand it, but it scares me. Which can be conscious or unconscious, and it can give the people trying to communicate any science a bit of a tough time from the outset because it's already somewhat of a hostile audience.
So my question then is, how can that problem be addressed by scientists? Because that sounds more like it's a problem with science literacy, which is more of an education problem.
I think I would go farther than that, actually. I think this whole issue is exacerbated by sort of the consumer society that we live in, right? I mean, when corporations try and sell stuff, and advertising is such a big part of our daily lives, and it's so structured as we are, they tend to use two mega memes, right? I mean, first is sort of the terror concept. There's the world out there is out to get you. There's something bad about the world, and you need to be afraid of the world because it will get you. And then, of course, the second part, which goes hand in hand, is magic. We have this magic cure. You don't need to understand what it is, but it will cure you and it will make you a better person. It'll make you more friends. They don't like facts and advertising. Facts tend to confuse things. They tend to backfire because once you understand it, it works against. So you have this sort of people are afraid of facts. They're afraid of knowledge.
Well, and it's like you were saying, because the type of scientific language and scientific jargon stuff is co-opted by people for different purposes and then ends up building this sort of fear-based psyche around all of those topics. And in answer to your question, Ethan, I don't think it's that this problem can't be addressed by scientists. And as we'll talk about a little bit later on, you know, scientists don't necessarily have to be separate from science education and science literacy and that kind of thing. Everybody has a different role, and scientists really are good people to communicate in their own fields if they choose to do it effectively, which takes effort. And I also don't think that any of this is a quick fix. It's all about changing that culture of fear, changing that culture of science illiteracy to be able to move forward. And some of the starting points are starting with more effective communication strategies. So although, as we've talked, I think we all realize it's really challenging, this isn't really an excuse for scientists not to try to communicate their science or to say, you know, somewhat, this is better left to someone else to increase that literacy so that I can then communicate. So we talked about, for journalists, in your blog post as well as a little bit last week, about how, or maybe it was several weeks ago, I don't know, the time just flies, how journalists and especially news outlets and that kind of thing can have these motivations that sort of go against really true science reporting because they're for profit and whatnot. And scientists themselves can also have motivating factors or unmotivating factors, as the case may be, as far as communicating science. Basically, sometimes there isn't much motivation at all. So for a research scientist, the goal is basically to run a lab. And this means that research grants for the money to run the lab need to come in. And this pretty much does not require presentation of the research outside of one's own field, or at least not very far outside of the field. So to be respected in one's field, similarly, you don't really need to leave it. You can basically stay cloistered in your own area of expertise and have a successful research career and a respectable research career by many of the metrics that scientists hold dear. So also, as we've discussed before, science has few absolute truths, and it can be really demotivating as far as publicly sharing information because it's so unsatisfying to people outside the sciences, and the kind of response that you get as, you know, you might be enthused on what you're doing, but when people are hearing these non-absolute truths, it can be really sort of disparaging. But like, what? You know, you've been working on this for a whole decade and you haven't come up with an answer? Well, you're thinking, oh my gosh, I've spent a decade working on this and look at this amazing body of work that I've come up with. So it's just an example of how some of the problems facing science journalists are anti-motivational factors for science as well. So
I don't know if I have used the word anti-motivational.
I don't think it's a real word, for the record.
No. Well, it could be. But I don't know. I think what you're pointing to there isn't so much of a, it's more of a symptom than a cause, right? I mean.
Of what?
Well, we have a culture, right, that sort of, well, one, it discounts real science as being boring and nerdy. I mean, that's kind of the cultural meme. It confuses science with technology. I mean, you know, we talked this morning about the new iPhone. We go, ooh, isn't that neat? And that's not really science. That's technology.
Well, we didn't say it was neat. We kind of were making fun of it.
Yeah, okay. And I mean, we also have a media which is more akin to a crack dealer trying to keep us on a hyper high. I mean, there needs to be something new and exciting, new and exciting, new and exciting. In times past, I mean, science was not seen this way. I mean, it was seen to be exciting, that even things like failed science were like, ooh, this offers a whole new insight into how the real world works. The whole idea of the ethos of progressivism, which is now almost seems to be a dirty word in some ways, right, that these things are innately important to me, not because they might be important to my life, because a lot of scientific discoveries don't actually amount to changes in one's life for decades down the road, if then, but my child's world will be better than mine. That was kind of a constant theme, and that made science important to me, even if it didn't mean a change in my life, it would mean a change in my child's life or generations to come. And that's usually something we've lost totally. We are so much, if it doesn't affect me, I don't care.
So, yeah, I mean, definitely people
So my point being is,
I think anti-motivation, what your question
isn't,
was.
That's like not a cause. It's just a symptom. I mean, you're saying they're anti-motivated, and if only they could get over this.
What I'm actually saying, I'm not talking about causes or symptoms of the whole situation. This is just a situation that is existing right now. And one of the blocks right now, as far as, you know, fostering a motivation for scientists to communicate better, is these lack of personal motivations to do so. So,
what do they do?
Well, they try. I mean, you basically have to take it as, you can't sit around as a scientist and gripe that no one understands you and no one appreciates you, and then don't try and change the situation. So as far as trying to foster a better science literacy in the public in general, that's one of the major goals. And another major goal that we need to have as a scientific community is this goal of becoming better communicators to the public. And it's sort of an ideological goal that will help to change society, and basically putting yourself into that role as one of your responsibilities. And that's a culture that doesn't exist in force right now in the scientific community, and one that I think really should.
Well, I mean, what I've heard from my interactions with a lot of the scientists in the skeptics movement is that one of the reasons why we don't see sort of promoters as much is that promoters of science are kind of looked down upon. And research scientists, it's not that they don't have the skills so much to promote their work, it's that they don't care about promoting their work.
Well, and that's sort of what I was talking about, right? There's no, in the science system, there's no explicit motivation to try to communicate your work to a general audience. And like you were saying, a lot of people are looked down on or look at as they're selling out or dumbing down what they're doing, which is really not what we're talking about here as far as trying to spread it wider. We're not, I'm not talking about sensationalization. I'm not dumbing down.
But I mean, like, let me ask you, like, in your science career, have you ever been required to take any kind of course on presenting your science or journalism?
Absolutely. Presenting our science to our peers.
Right.
To our peers.
Right.
So you haven't taken like song and dance or anything to do it to the masses.
And there are things that are, there are programs available, but there is nothing required, and it is absolutely not required to have a good career in science. And I would just like to say that, I mean, I think that everybody has different skills innately in them. And there are some brilliant scientists that are horrible communicators, as anyone who's taken a multitude of undergrad science courses
can
tell you.
We'll need some names, Jenna.
No. But that's okay. You know, it's okay to not be able to do everything. But as far as a bigger population of people in the scientific communication that do make it their business to be good at that, it's something that we need if we're going to create a more aware public.
And I think, too, I mean, we're kind of kicking on scientists here, but I think this is reflected. You used one line I thought was quite telling. You know, how we tend to grime and we tend to bitch and bemoan about the situation, but we don't do anything about it. Well, I mean, that's not a science thing.
No.
I mean, we're talking about science, so it's important. But I mean, that, again, it's another cultural meme that seems to permeate every part of our society.
For sure. And I mean, we've, you know, griped on journalists before, and I'm sure that maybe we'll have another segment where we can gripe on the consuming public. And today we're griping on scientists because, yes, it is definitely a responsibility thing about not relinquishing responsibility to another group, but in society in general, whether it has to do with communication, whether it has to do with carbon footprints, to take responsibility, each and one of us, on ourselves. So, yes, when talking about what can be done, we've talked sort of vaguely about, you know, fostering a society of better communicating scientists. And the authors of this Nature Chemistry article put forward an overarching communication strategy that I like very much. basically in the article, they frame it in the context of chemistry, but the idea is that you start with the target audience in mind, as well as the desired outcome of the communication, and then you work backwards without assumption, which is key, to design the most appropriate communication strategy. So this seems to be sort of logical when you just read it over, but like many things that seem very logical, it's often not really a doctrine that's followed. So the idea that they're trying to get at here is that at every single decision, you can ask, is this the most effective way to get this specific point across to this specific audience in order to make them understand this subject matter? And basically to throw out the window the strategies that you thought at the outset were going to be effective, and to throw out, you know, the things, oh, I'm good at this, I can do this, but to approach every situation afresh with the idea of your audience in mind, and again, focusing, looking, visualizing, if you know you're in a sports mood, on what you want that outcome to be. So it's a very important part of this strategy to not think of the general public as one big, globby, homogenous group. So this falls under the category of lumping people into groups of like me and not like me. So for scientists, it can be easy to see people as scientists and as non-scientists. And this is especially easy for this group because the gap in the scientific knowledge and grasp of the scientific method that we've been talking about here, a lot of scientists feel that this runs deeper than just career choice. So for many people in the sciences, being a, quote, scientist is more of a personality trait than a profession. So I've personally heard this used as an insult. I've personally heard this used as a compliment, like, wow, that person is a real scientist. And they're not talking about the research, and they're not talking about the goals or of the research or the outcomes. What they're talking about is, wow, that person is a critical thinker or whatever. And this is a term that can really easily be used to split people into us and them in this particular context. So for when you want to communicate to people like these authors are saying, you really need to know your audience. And for people to communicate to the general public, this means understanding that the public is a really highly segmented population made up of countless groups with distinct aptitudes and motivations and lifestyles and beliefs. So communication to any audience can only be effective when people doling out the information take some time to understand to whom they're speaking. So when we're talking about this in the scientific communication context, you know, am I talking to a skeptics meeting? Am I talking to people in a town hall meeting that are scared of a flu outbreak? Am I talking to a bunch of teenagers who thinks that, you know, there are only certain things that are cool to pay attention to? And to really not see the public as just people that don't understand science, but to sort of understand that they have their own motivations and understandings as well. The most important message that this Nature Chemistry article has to do with developing communication methods that actually engage people and not just preach to them. So one model of communication in the sciences that's sort of been developed is to think of a knowledge deficit that you are filling by providing knowledge. But these authors argue, as well as continuing experience and research, showing that this model simply doesn't work. It's sort of like, you know, memorizing lists of numbers or memorizing, I'm trying to think of, for me it's spelling, but other people can spell, but, you know, like world capitals or things that aren't actually changing the way that you think and the way that you view the world around you, but just sort of having facts. And this isn't the way to help people understand science. We're talking about learning how to engage an audience in active learning process. So simply, yeah, providing that digestible data isn't going to help out. It's not that the information isn't good, it's that there's no real relationship with the audience. So we want people to feel that knowledge makes them powerful and not powerless. And so if you're just giving people information, this doesn't give intellectual power, as they're still not in control of what's coming at them. For all they know, it could be something that isn't is sort of in that category of slanted stuff that comes to you when you're ignorant of a topic. So you want to have people feel comfortable with the subject matter and engaged in processing that information so that they can tell the difference between what is real and what is bunk.
Yeah, and this actually makes a lot of sense to me because I've been sort of realizing the same thing has happened for a long time in the field of teaching history. And that so often you're given a set of facts and then you're giving a test and it says, okay, recite these facts now and now you know history. Well, that's completely opposite. You just remembered a few things and now you're going to forget them
or
a week
later.
Or
didn't remember them depending on
how
the test went.
Or you cheated, maybe, or something, right? So, yeah, it makes a lot of sense to me that we need to stop sort of the quote kind of lecture style and engage in a more interactive and a more dynamic form of education.
Especially when we're talking and for formal education in some respects, as well as most importantly, when talking to people, not necessarily in an educational setting, but in a like a media setting or something like that, to try and just use a different tone, even if it is a one-sided lecture or discussion or whatever, which in some forms like print media, you can't exactly have a two-way discussion, but just to change that tone and to put things in certain contexts to help people form their own ideas and contextualize what's coming at them.
But again, we're going back to the Italians, right? The story we did earlier. What people wanted was to be empowered. They wanted a certain degree of certainty so they knew what to do. But the science actually left them feeling less. The scientists didn't. And what to be in charge with is because they did provide certainty. But the real science would have actually made them feel more disempowered, more out of control. I don't know when it's going to happen. It could happen. It might happen. Who knows? And that actually wouldn't, it's opposite.
So I there's a real distinction between, I think, what you're talking about and what I'd like to discuss a little more. So when you're talking about, you know, talking about the real information, which is, you know, the earthquake, I don't know, versus no, those to me fall into the same category of just facts. So if we're going to put in a third option for the scientists to go through some of the statistics, like when we're talking about how many earthquakes have four quakes, the fact that some four quakes are false alarm, why four quakes happen. That is then empowering the public to use a base of knowledge to then interpret and contextualize the advice that scientists are giving them on that specific topic. So it's all about, again, building that literacy and comfortability, which also isn't a word, in an area to then be able to put facts that, because you need facts, facts are going to happen, that are coming at you no matter what source, to sort of be able to evaluate them a little more critically. And obviously, not everyone can be experts or even oriented in every field. But if you create a more widespread general literacy about things like causation and correlation, about things like the scientific method, about things like the difference between a hypothesis or a theory or a fact, then people will be able to be oriented in a specific field a heck of a lot more quickly.
And to actually answer my question, maybe what could have made it empowering is to realize, okay, we can't predict earthquakes. So instead of going down that road, go to things, well, if it's going to happen, how can I design my building to withstand an earthquake? How can I be prepared if it's going to happen? And use that as a means to feel empowered by the information you're given because you now understand that what it is in context.
Yeah, and to understand why those probabilities exist and like what is an earthquake and where does it come from? And things become a little bit less scary, although the consequences aren't necessarily when you understand them a little better. It makes you feel a little bit more comfortable in not having to rely on just the words coming out of that dude's mouth, but sort of your own understanding of the situation. So as I see it, we still have a lot of problems, obviously, in the way the public views science, and that people are working on this. I also, however, am extremely optimistic about the future in this respect. I know that the current situation doesn't actually warrant that much optimism, maybe, but I really believe that we have more tools at our disposable. We don't have disposable tools. We might have disposable tools. However, we do have tools that are at our disposal to change this situation. And more of them are happening every day. So when we're talking about, you know, fostering a type of communication that helps with engagement, again, we need this two-way communication. And so what kind of venues are we having before us now that we've never had so many of before? But the interactive medias that are coming at us through social media, through internet engagement, and through blogging and that kind of thing, and voices that have never really been able to exist before, never been able to give voice to something before, are suddenly able to have an interaction with a public that can feel comfortable in engaging on a variety of topics. So we have many of the traditional media still around, of course, which cannot and should not be ignored. But the new models for using them to foster scientific literacy are currently being worked on. So, for example, there has been an explosion of popular and bestseller books on scientific topics lately. So The Brain That Changes Itself, The Poisoner's Handbook, A Brief History of Time, all of them, you know, are starting to be able to be things that are cool to read. And so some of that interest and public interest in scientific discovery is coming back, because there was, you're absolutely right, a time when scientists were sort of rock stars. So this kind of enthusiasm for consuming science is totally gold. And the most important thing about these works is they're actually written by scientists who were willing to alter their normal communication styles to produce effective work for their target audiences. So scientists can and should be communicating in their own field, but not necessarily by their own rules that have stood for so many years. And of course, I touched on, we have this major venue for interactive scientific communication on the internet. So specifically, science blogs and the like make frontline science available to a broad audience from a number of different sources, and this is really key. So a single discovery can be discussed by several different voices, and people from all walks of life are able to find someone that they trust and a voice that speaks to them to communicate the same information. And this really enables everyone to engage, because it doesn't alienate people that maybe do have a different ideological view than the person writing about it or something like that, and really opens that field to this incredible network of discussion over myriad scientific topics. So this model for this communication model is really crucial, and we really need to, as scientists, start to embrace these venues that ask people to question us, and not just, you know, shy away from any questions or challenge, but really welcome that kind of engagement as something that's going to foster a trust and an understanding with your audience. So when it comes to scientists communicating science, the most important things seems to be to get out of the ivory tower, and not only to get out of it, but to burn it down.
Burn
that tower. So in my science communication utopia, people are standing around the water cooler discussing what would not be considered mundane science, and kids would be shunned for being uncool if they didn't understand the difference between correlation and causation. But for this level of public understanding and engagement, scientists, journalists, and the consuming public, like we were saying, all need to stop being adversaries and putting responsibility on each other and start being on the same team and all making effort to change the situation. So scientists really should not fancy themselves as preachers or as gatekeepers to knowledge, but as the best kind of teachers, those that reach their students personally and that learn from them as well. Everything in the real world involves science, like we were talking about. But I truly don't know how many people really believe that right now. And I really hope that through hard work and persistence, the level of scientific comfort and literacy can be increased substantially.
That's so typical of you scientific types, telling everyone how to live their lives.
That's us. No real information.
Well, so how will you do that then?
This will be continued, I'm sure, in a lengthy blog where she will give detailed instructions on how to restructure at least the scientific community.
No, I think general society. Let's restructure all of society.
We're going to go for utopia, go all the way.
All right. Done and done.
All right, done. Well, thanks, Jonah. That was an incredibly interesting discussion. And Don as well, thank you for your contributions. Let's go to our skeptical highlights. We're running out of time on today's show.
I've got one here. Occupy Wall Street. As some of you may have heard, but I doubt most of you had, there's currently going on in the United States a mass protest. For over 2 weeks, protesters have been having a sort of Arab Spring kind of occupation of Wall Street. Well, it's actually parked near Wall Street, but close enough. It has spread to over 20 cities in the United States. The protest actually was called for by Canada's own magazine, Adbusters, but now has active support by many major labor unions. They are protesting the standard issues, corporate bailouts, tax cuts for the rich, a reduced social spending, union busting, money politics, yada, yada. One of actually the most popular signs I loved was, "I can't afford a lobby. I am the 99%. This 99% is a big theme. Okay, so interesting, you may say, but why did I mention on the show? Well, first, it's important that we, the 99%, remain informed and engaged about what's going on. Maybe we should have our own occupying Bay Street. But secondly, and as a skeptic lesson, the way the media has sort of distorted reality here. If you scan the corporate media, you will get occasional small stories about it, but nothing really very big. Compare that to the press that they got for the Tea Party, which was huge. In fact, over 700 people were arrested, and you didn't hear hardly anything about it in the main press. Whereas if you look at the alternative press, the independent press, it's like all over the place. And it's just an object lesson how mass media, as we were talking about with sort of the science of communication, mass media can distort what we even think of as the facts to begin with. And it was just an interesting objective lesson. You may or may not support them. That's up to you. That's a different issue. But it's just the tainted glasses that people have. That's it.
Really briefly, I'd just like to remind people to go check out the causticsodapodcast.com as a recent episode just went up on bacteria and lots of bacterial infections and whatnot with yours truly as a guest host.
Excellent. Well, I guess that's the end of the show. So this is Ethan, your free-thinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
This is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
This is Jenna saying, really, really, the real word really is amazing.
Okay, Jenna.
Amazing.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
To the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rose. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. The rising of the Milky Way. The cosmos is full.